chief executive and co-founder of the Eden Project in Cornwall, which is an environmental centre which is open to the public. So we like to call it the world's first rock and roll scientific foundation, because we use popular language to take difficult subjects, to make people aware of issues, but also to engage them. And what is distinct about Eden is that we never tell people what to think, or indeed what we think. We just give them the information on which to come to their own considerations, which is, I think, the reason why Eden is the only commercially viable scientific foundation that is involved with the environment in the world. Poverty is not just an important issue, it is probably the most important issue. We have, since time immemorial, built our societies on religions and beliefs that talk about the equality of mankind under their God, and have then, in the way that we conduct ourselves, demonstrated that all the ills that we point out in the various tracts by which we lead our lives are things that we just will not address. And when one sees the effects of poverty and knows uplifting stories of those that have been in poverty, that have been able to extricate themselves from it, you understand that the demeaning of all of us comes from not addressing the issues of giving people access to that which they need to provide them with shelter, food, and an optimistic outlook on the future. The alleviation of poverty, I think, is something we find really difficult to talk about, in as much as poverty is generic, in the sense that when we hear of an individual that is poor, we can somehow emotionally engage. But the mass of poverty and the, if you like, embedded structures that we have created around the world that keep people poor and not able to access resources is something we just don't know how to deal with. And where you see examples of addressing poverty, for example, with Muhammad Yunus's Grameen Bank, it is just absolutely extraordinary how quickly, given the weaponry of some access to capital, that people can, within one generation, transform their lives from, if you like, an abject situation to one in which they not only have houses, but they're starting to send their kids to further education and so on. And we live our lives under a lie here in the West, which is that we somehow define the poor as other, because that helps us. It's their own fault, is the kind of subtext. And it's just not true. And if we can't address the issue of poverty, we will all be brought down by it, because as we come to a point where we all realize that resources are not infinite and people are hungry, they will cut down rainforests, they will migrate en masse if they get flooded, and will bring the rest of the world down around the ears of those who have, rather poetically, by the impact of those who have not. So if we do not deal with poverty, it is not only a moral shame, there is also at core an issue of our own survival in actually redressing those imbalances. There is a link between poverty and consumerism which is very hard to understand, in as much as consumerism can be argued to take some people out of poverty. But our desire to consume things in the West at a price that we've been spoilt to be allowed to pay is meaning that we in the developed world are not actually paying what we should be paying for that which we consume. It has been argued most notably and eruditely by Claire Short when she was minister at DFID, that if we were to remove all trade barriers, the developing world would have access to funds in the region. It's rather pat, I know, to say 100 times more than global aid, but surely a hugely significant sum above global aid. And when you see how much you're paying for your chocolate or your raw resources, which are then processed, I mean, Germany, I believe, is the world's greatest coffee producer, in as much as There are huge taxes on bringing in unroasted beans, for example, which means that the huge chunks of the added value of our consumerism are actually made in the West, or the developed world, rather. And therefore, consumerism leads directly to poverty in as much as we do not allow those that produce the raw resources to get the right reward for the work that they are doing, or the right return on their land, in order that we might have excess. So we are funding our well-being through the exploitation of others, and we argue it in the name of the free market, that everything has a price. One can get very political about it, but you asked me a straight question about consumerism and poverty. And while a certain amount of consumerism creates, certain types of consumerism lead to wealth creation, we know, for example, from work on one of the Eden books, which is Confessions of an Eco-Sinner by Fred Pierce. He travels to the sweatshops of Bangladesh and India, and the women who are working there for $1.50, $2 a day, are begging him not to tell a story which encourages us not to buy the sweatshop stuff, because it has bought them a minimal amount of independence. And I can see that, and we've got to be very careful that we don't allow our developed world moralities to then infect some very positive moves which you're seeing there. For example, the carpet trade, you'll be aware of the ban on the use of child labour. You see an almost like-for-like change from child labour in carpet making to child prostitution. So our high-minded ideals have had exactly the opposite intent. So consumerism can take some people out of poverty, but you normally find that it is through exploiting the cost of labour, and you see a huge drag of people from the land to the cities. We're now 50% of our populations globally are in cities. And the effect of that is that because food is generally subsidised around the world, that the right value for an agrarian life is not being paid. So we're creating the seeds of our own destruction by dragging everybody into cities where there isn't much employment, and that which there is exploitative. So a complex picture, highly charged with Western morality, is not going to get us through this. But consumerism, de facto, when it is artificially subsidized, is a creator of poverty, not an alleviator of poverty. It's a very interesting question how you alleviate poverty through your purchasing decisions. I would prefer to address it with a real example, say, of how Eden operates. I think once you take on board the global poverty and how your purchasing decisions can make a difference, one can come up with the cliches about buying fair trade and all that. But within the fair trade movement, there is a crashing lack of honesty by the relative improvement there is in fair trade rather than the absolute. I also think one of the weaknesses of the fair trade movement is that many of the people, not all, but many of the people are so obsessed with the concept of fair trade with a capital F that they don't realize that the scale at which one needs to transform fair trading or ethical trading or whatever you wish to call it, it's a monster. And a lot of people are quite happy to have million-pound businesses or several million-pound businesses when you need to be talking about billion-pound businesses to affect global change. So if we make it from the point of view of a university or institution, and we would be an institution, I guess, we were very political about the way we do our procurement. We have 2,400 local suppliers. We approached it from the point of view that we wanted to affect change in the suppliers, and we wanted to have a carrot as well as a stick that went with it. So we have a project called Waste Neutral, which means that we purchase the same tonnage of recycled materials as we're forced to put into landfill, and we're ever decreasing the amount of waste we have. But part of our contracts to our suppliers are that we want them to go waste neutral too within 18 months of getting a contract. and at the end of the next 18-month period, we would like to see their suppliers go waste neutral too. And I think in using capitalism as a mechanism for affecting change in your suppliers is a very potent force, because one of the things that keeps people poor, if you like, is the constant thrall in which they're held to the banks. And you can't grow your businesses or grow your opportunities if you can't get access to capital. And one of the ways of enabling your suppliers to get access to capital is to give them longer-term contracts, which are then bankable with banks. So we start from that perspective, that first of all, the business relationship should be fair. We have a rule that we will always buy local, even if the prices are higher, provided that those high prices are a function simply of geography and not business incompetence. We're pretty ruthless about analysing what constitutes local. I mean, with our agricultural produce, 80% of what we consume is local. And that doesn't mean that we've bought our meat in Cornwall, for example, or fish in Cornwall. It has to actually have been grown and caught in Cornwall. A lot of people seem to think that by buying from some supermarket in your territory, that's good enough. And by putting those sort of things in place, you provide, if you like, a very transparent framework for the transactions in which you're engaged. I think the moral issues of the products which actually come from outside of your boundary are quite simple. People try to turn it into rocket science, but you can establish that all the raw resources you receive come from ethical sources. Your finance director might not be quite so happy if you have to pay a premium, and universities, I guess, are under the same strictures that we are. But it is my view that places of higher education should also be places of higher moral awareness, and therefore they should carry out all their transactions in a manner which would enable them to sleep well at night, knowing that they had done the best by those that supply them. I'm just pretty draconian about it. I don't think it's actually even a question of debate. And that's an end to it. Poverty takes many forms. We're talking here about poverty in terms of access to capital. Poorness. I mean, one can also have poverty in terms of access to democratic institutions and frameworks and so on. Eden works across a lot of territories, because we're interested in exploring what being a rounded personality is like. And we work, for example, with the Green Futures Project in South Africa, which takes young men and women from the townships and trains them up to become professional horticulturists. And the transformative effect of that, when someone has access to a skill that is then has a premium on it, is extraordinary. And the reason we're doing that is because the inspirational guy who set it up wanted South Africa to have a professional horticultural industry that could, you know, if you like, take control of the whole agronomy sector in South Africa. And there are very few places that teach it. And it was predominantly at the white universities, or what were the white universities. And our experience watching it is it's fantastically humbling, because they come for, three of them come every summer over here, and our team go over there at other times of the year. So we have seen at first hand the transformative effects of giving people access to resource. Also, we do the Eden Gardens for Life project, which twins schools in Kenya, India, and the UK. When there's a huge amount of truancy, for example, in Kenya, and the Gardens for Life project has had a rather unexpected side effect, that the production of food in the school means that an awful lot of the youngsters whose parents had died through AIDS actually started to return to school, because they could get a square meal based on what was being produced at the school. So the access just to food can have another benefit, that people can, once they're eating, they can learn, and once they're learning stuff, they can get a livelihood at the end of it. But this is stuff that everybody knows who's listening, and we all know that. On a more mundane level, but nonetheless horrid level, we work on something called a Great Day Out in the UK, which takes people, homeless people and people in prison hostels, and runs projects, again, horticultural projects. And that is a different type of poverty. It's a poverty of experience, often, and a lack of self-esteem, which when you give people opportunities to do stuff in a public arena, we do quite a lot of stuff in the public arena. For example, this year we're doing the Chelsea Flower Show, and it's going to be the biggest garden in Chelsea's history, and it's all been put together by homeless people and people from hostels. But again, last year when we did it for the first time, a very significant percentage of those that got engaged then had the confidence to go out and change their lives and get jobs and all the rest of it, coming from having access to people who told them they were not a waste of space and learning talents that enabled them to feel they had a value in the outside world. And it's, again, transformative. I mean, I think the reason why I'm telling you this is it's very easy to think of poverty as being something over there, you know, in other parts of the world. I mean, in Britain, the gap is bigger today than it was 100 years ago between rich and poor. And so much of what drives the projects that we see in Britain is a misunderstanding of why people don't succeed. And time after time after time, I go to seminars with people talking about long-term unemployment and poverty, and the people in the room have no effing idea how people get into that situation and how they get out of it. So you will see, I think since I've been doing Heligan and Eden, there must have been four or five different initiatives to help the long-term unemployed. And what's really interesting is they are all 1 year long, as if the Treasury was saying that it takes a year to support somebody. And our professional experience is it takes a year to feel confident that you can do something, and then another year to become fully employable. And what actually happens in many cases of long-term unemployment is that people at the end of a year are told, we're now letting you go, and then the company is meant to take them on, and yet they're not yet totally employable, so they drop them. So you've actually reinforced a sense of failure rather than created a sense of success. And yet when I look across both my organizations and I look at some of the most loyal and able people there, they are people who, once they had been given a start, have made a right good go of it and again transformed their lives. The problem is that so many of the people who are in charge of the resources that enable people to transform their lives have no understanding of what is needed to transform people's lives. Bear in mind that Muhammad Yunus, with the Grameen Bank, was told by all bankers you couldn't do microcredit. You see, we're so damn conservative, and the universities, in my view, have been pretty damn poor at addressing these issues. And I'm really glad this initiative is taking place, because it's very easy to talk about, but doing stuff, actually getting dirt under your fingernails, is a very different thing altogether.